Welcome to episode 9 of the Adamola Bookman podcast. This time we're doing a Welsh and Everton legend, Neville Southall, and his book, The Bin Man Chronicles, co-written by James Corbett. This is a fairly conventional autobiography, wouldn't you say, Johnny? Hi, by the way.
Hi, Al. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good.
Yeah, it is. And yeah, I thought it was fun, actually.
I thought bits and pieces were fun. Some bits were funner than others.
Yeah, maybe. But I really warmed to Southall.
Yeah, I think I did too. He's a simple man.
He's quite a character, isn't he?
Yeah, if by character you mean total weirdo.
Yeah, he's a strange fish. And that's what I liked about him. He's like a big benevolent caveman or something.
Yeah, benevolent caveman. Yeah, that sounds about right. Anyway. Yeah, in his heart, he means well.
Ah, he's lovely. He's lovely. Like, it was funny, like, he was at Everton for, I think at different points he said 16 and 17 years, but he felt that no one there trusted him in the club hierarchy. They all thought he was kind of a madman, loose cannon and stuff.
Yeah, a madman and a loose cannon, and in a way, not at all, right? He's a man of contradictions.
Yeah, he is. He is. Well, you know, in Crouch's book and in footballers' book generally, I suppose goalkeepers are the drummers of the football world, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right.
Like Crouch talked about goalies just being odd, and I suppose we saw it in this book, didn't we?
Yeah, we certainly did. I mean, he sort of embraces all the sides of a game that most people don't care for, I think.
Go on, tell me more. What do you mean by that?
Well, he seems to really thrive on the abuse. That was good for him. He liked the abuse. He loved it, getting stick from the fans. He said all his favourite stadiums were the close ones in, where we could all hear people screaming at him.
Okay, before we get into the book, I had a couple of questions for you.
Mm-hmm.
Firstly, what do you think about people who wear goalkeeper shirts?
Yeah, it's a very interesting phenomenon. I mean, I'll give a kid a pass. If you're under 12, go for your life. If you wear a goal, especially if you are a little goalkeeper, go for it. And I'm someone who wears a football shirt. I know people have strong opinions about that, but I'm happy to represent my team. I bowl around. I was bowling around in a football shirt today. I've never wanted to own a goalkeeper shirt. Not once ever.
What about a tracksuit?
I had a tracksuit when I was a kid.
Would you wear like a full Forest tracksuit now?
Yes, I probably would.
Apparently, humans are drawn to the colours red and orange, which is why goalkeeper shirts are often this garish red and orange. You kick at them. You kick the ball towards it.
That's a real psychological thing, eh?
Well, I picked that tidbit up somewhere down the line. I have no idea where, and I've stored it away in my memory as if it's absolute, you know, copper fastened fact, but who knows?
Well, as everything you say, Johnny, I take it to heart and I believe it 100%.
Okay, very good.
He was born in 1958 in London, though, in North Wales. But it seems like he was born in 1928 in Llandudno in Wales. It really did seem like a bygone time, his childhood. He didn't seem to have any amenities. They walked everywhere. His schooling was fascinating, in as much as the teachers just didn't bother and he was just allowed to go outside and play football. He was allowed to go to any class, which was having a football lesson. So he just turned up doing that. I mean, he really had no schooling at all, eh?
When we were doing the Crouch book, Crouch was playing at one point under Graham Taylor. Southall finished with Everton and was in 97. These guys almost overlapped, but it's like they're just from totally different planets.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, it's a cliche, eh? But the football world has changed so immeasurably in that time. I mean, like, if you were like a lawyer in 1988 and you're a lawyer now, okay, you've got email and stuff and Zoom, I guess that makes life easier, but it's still the same really, right? You still have the same experiences, but everything's changed here.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's absolutely bonkers, you know.
Bonkers is a word that crops up quite a great deal.
Maybe I'll speak like Southall for the whole thing. You old nugget.
I love that one. Nugget's good.
We read Paul McGrath and we read Ian Wright. So they're from similar periods. For me, Paul McGrath is talking about a lot of things that were very, you know, famous in Ireland. Reading a book about Everton of the 80s, you could be talking about Everton of the 60s to me, you know. I like, other than like Peter Reid, like the occasional player, Kevin Sheedy again because of the Irish connection, but I didn't know any of these guys.
Well, yeah. I'm a bit older than you, so I remember the tail end of that Everton team. My first proper football year was 1988, where I took an interest. And so, yeah, I remember these players. I remember your Graham Sharps and your Kevin Ratcliffe. Oh, Rats, by the way. Oh, Rats. There's the old beating heart. He loves Rats. Kevin Ratcliffe, not the rodent. But so I do remember it. And then the 90s stuff, I remember a bit more. But that was very much when he was on the wane.
Yeah, and he even like in those latter years, and he was getting a lot of abuse for his weight and stuff as he got towards the end of his Everton days. But if you look back at the footage, like, it's just inconceivable that he'd be on a football pitch looking like that now.
No kidding.
Yeah, and has had two mouthfuls of beer in his life.
In his life. I mean, he says, yeah, two sips of lager. He didn't like it and he never went back. No one likes your first sip of lager. Nobody does.
Yeah.
I mean, he talks about how Howard Kendall would, he didn't like people who wouldn't socialise, who wouldn't go out drinking. He found it was all an essential part of a team bonding. He says Neville Southall, he just thought, oh, he's a hopeless case, and just left him alone.
Southall would like tell him to fuck off.
Yeah, he would. Just going back to his youth, if I can, very, very quickly, I've got a couple of notes. Do you remember what his mum and dad were called?
No, but I do remember other things about his father, which were interesting.
All right. Well, this might have stuck out more to me as an English person, but his mum and dad...
Oh, yeah, sorry. I do remember what they were called. Go on, tell me.
Yeah, Fred and Rose,
Fred and Rose.
Is a fairly inauspicious name for your parents, isn't it? Like,
that's incredible.
Okay, just for some context, Fred and Rose is a funny pair of names because of Fred and Rose West, who were the famous murderers from Gloucester.
I thought the book was, at the start, I was like, God, this is going to be so dull. And I guess this is the nature of autobiographies. They often start in that kind of way, but it was such a kind of outline of things that happened. There was no kind of insights or, you know. But I really did warm to Neville. I thought he was just such a character.
Well, that's it. Most autobiographies, I think what we've been watching is you normally start with a chapter like, which is a particular high, right, in the career, and then you move into the chronological order of their life or a particular low. But yeah, this really was just this happened, then that happened, then this happened, then that happened.
Yeah.
And some was more interesting than others. I mean, for sure. And obviously some of that's context. Some are, you know, I'm more interested in the stuff that I remember than the stuff I don't remember. But it is a good reader.
Yeah. Again, he's from this different world. And I guess, you know, he loved playing football. As you said, he wasn't very academic. He had a hard time in school. It seemed like school just kind of passed him by a bit. He played football a lot.
He also did some gymnastics. Do you remember that bit?
I don't know.
Yeah, he was in the gymnastics class at school and they went to do a performance in a mental asylum.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure you don't call that now, but if that's what he calls it, it's good enough for me, eh? Yeah.
That was funny, yeah.
He said his gymnastics class were running around in their underpants in front of what he in the loony bin. So, which is a un-PC term nowadays, but yeah, it did sound a very weird thing for him to have to do.
That is funny. He just couldn't get it. He couldn't get enough of football. He was playing for a pub team, playing for his uncle's pub team, and then he got into
when he was 12.
When he was 12. It just seemed that like he just kind of went along with things. He didn't really have any particular ambitions of playing football. I think the whole idea just was kind of alien to him. Maybe football wasn't on the telly so much. You weren't surrounded by football so much. So it didn't seem like such an option to him, maybe.
Do you remember what his ambition was when he was a kid?
No.
He wanted to be a postman. And it never happened for him. He wanted to be a postman.
That's nice. But he is, of course, the book is called The Binman Chronicles. And he says, I wasn't really a binman for very long.
Just a couple of months.
Couple of months, but I guess that was just the nickname that he got when he was at Everton. But he was a hod carrier. Did you know what a hod carrier was?
Yeah, I knew what a hod carrier was.
So what is
I think
hod?
it's like the stick with the V on the top, isn't it, where you put the bricks.
Yeah, that's hard work, isn't it? Carrying bricks up and down like ladders all day.
Well, that would get you fit, wouldn't it? I can't imagine an activity which would get you fitter than that, to be honest.
Yeah, I was a landscape gardener for a couple of weeks. That was tough going.
Yeah, I've never really had a job which made me fit. I delivered furniture for 6 months. I was
That's not
slightly
bad.
less fat.
That's not bad. But yeah, he had a few teams sniffing around him when he was a young fella. Everton being one of them, because he was close to Liverpool, as we said, but nothing ever came of it.
Well, do you remember his first brush with professional football? He did a tour to Germany. They went to Dusseldorf, and apparently he got offered a place at the Dusseldorf Academy. But as he says, I couldn't be bothered. So that didn't happen. Never mind.
It's real. It's real Southall, isn't it?
Yeah, just, well, maybe not today.
So he eventually went to Bury, which is up near Manchester, and he was there. He was there for a year, I think. He was player of the year, and then he eventually signed for Everton.
He had other offers to join other teams, but the manager of Bury gave him a lift to the train station. So he won his undying loyalty with that. So
Yeah,
good
that
for
was
him
so
there.
funny. Someone else was in for him, and he was like, "But
Wigan.
they didn't know that whatever his name was had brought me to the train station, and therefore I was bound to go to Bury."
I mean, there's your loyalty, eh? Which you've got to say is a Southall trademark, isn't it? Like, I mean, there's a man who is loyal to his teams and his people.
He seems so clueless. Like when he goes to Everton, Howard Kendall was the manager of Everton. And he had just come from Blackburn. He was coming down to Liverpool, so he was close enough, passing by Bury. So Southall just started catching lifts off Howard Kendall until he realised a couple of weeks in that it's not really the done thing to get your boss to go so far out of the way.
That's how much of
Really,
a nugget I was, he says.
that's how much of a nugget I was exactly. He said, okay, I better start traveling myself. So the trip was training ground to the station. Like to the local station, then train to Liverpool, then to Manchester, then another one to Bury, and then a bus home. This is golden Southall, you know?
Yeah, I mean, he went to some real lengths to make it happen for him.
Yeah. He joined Everton when Liverpool were really in their pomp. And he talks with great affection about the people from Liverpool. And like Scousers broadly. And he does talk when he talks about the Hillsborough stuff later and Dalglish and stuff like that. He just talks about the city broadly, not just Everton fans and the kind of the people of Liverpool. And he's obviously quite fond of them, but
Yeah, I've got a direct quote here. Scousers, they're a bit special. They've all got really good hearts. They're quite aggressive. Well, they've not all got good hearts, have they? Because we've read Joey Barton's autobiography.
He makes it very clear that being an Everton fan was to kind of just live in the shadow of Liverpool. So he came to this, and I didn't really fully. I think when we read the McGrath book, he talked about Everton being strong in the 80s. And I don't think I ever really knew that. I remember I knew that United had beaten them in FA Cup final, but I don't think I knew that they'd won the league in the 80s a couple of
Yeah,
times.
twice in the
Yeah.
80s under Howard Kendall, who seems to be a bit of a forgotten man, really.
Well, it doesn't help. He came back to Everton twice and it didn't work out, you know.
No, he didn't come, and I believe he also by the last time he came back, he was really in the grips of alcoholism.
Oh,
There's
is
a
he?
point where he talks about Howard Kendall, and when the third time Howard Kendall came back, and Howard Kendall said to him, "I really love you, you know that," and he said he didn't want to hear that. Because Howard Kendall was wearing a dressing gown with his bollocks hanging out, telling him he loves him.
Yeah, I think I wrote down that quote. That was so funny, I thought. But yeah, so he arrived at a good time. you know, his timing was good. Things started to pick up for Everton. They bought Andy Gray, and Peter Reid is the other person that I would have known from this team, because he played well into the 90s, didn't he? But when Everton signed him, he was kind of, it sounded like his career was might fall apart as a result of injury, but obviously things turned around for him.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so it's funny, like he talks about they made it to the League Cup final in 1984, and they went to, it was over two legs or there was a replay, and they lost eventually to Graham Souness' goal. Liverpool won. But this had a massive transformative effect, because Everton, for the first time, it kind of first time since the 60s maybe, had gone toe-to-toe with like the best team in England, and Southall was then of the view that they were as good as them. And really from there, it kind of did go on an upward curve from there.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, that's it. That's when they all began to believe, eh? Well, certainly that's when Southall began to believe.
They were
a good team.
He said it in 1984, in the 11 years since Everton had last won a trophy, Liverpool had won 17, including like European Cups and leagues and stuff. What an absolute heartbreaker. Yeah, he said that year they played, the same year they beat beat Watford in the FA Cup final. And he said all the talk was about Elton John and John Barnes, because Elton John was the owner of Watford. But they won the cup, and he said he was so embarrassed that he didn't want to go and collect his medal, and he hated the lap of honor. And this is something that comes up over and over. There was a post game banquet, and the only reason he went is because his parents wanted to go.
Yeah, that's right. He also said just before the cup final is when he had his first experiences with the media, and he did an interview with the Sun, and this was obviously pre Hillsborough Sun in Liverpool. But one of the players said, oh, you've got to ask for some money at the end. And so he did, and the Sun printed it. And as he said, they made me look like a right twat.
But yeah, like, again, going back to this idea that he's kind of like, you know, like, I guess it's kind of product of where he, of the time that he's from, but he didn't play any youth football. He didn't even know that there was such a thing as the under 21s. Isn't that remarkable?
Yeah, it really is. But then he says, as I say, it was a different time. And that, I mean, I guess you wouldn't know, would you? I mean, I can't imagine he was sitting down reading the newspapers. He was just out playing.
Yeah.
So
he's a reader. He's a big reader.
Is he?
He says that.
Oh, well, yeah. Maybe now. I've got to say, I don't think at the time, do you think? I don't think
no,
so.
No, at the time, I would have thought. Yeah, no, as in when he was playing, I think he started reading, you know, because they spend so much time faffing about, as Crouchy told us, you know.
Yeah, that's it. The free time. He had a real problem with that, didn't he, Johnny?
Jesus, yeah, like, as in, he sounds like he might have been a little bit hyperactive or something, right? Because he just couldn't deal with downtime.
I looked in the index, and his wife of 11 years has like two mentions.
Yeah.
And one of them is just so excruciating. So he got caught up in some sort of kiss and tell story, which he says wasn't as black and white as they said. But he thought what he needed to do was to declare his love for his wife. So, you know, why not wear a T-shirt which says, I love my wife on it? He wore a T-shirt which says, I love my wife on it. And he says, did it work? Well, maybe a year later she forgave me.
Well, what's more, he also says that that is the start of footballers wearing messages on shirts. He invented it.
Maybe he's right, but the worst one ever, right? The worst one ever. And then one of his teammates, whose name escapes me, not a famous player, also wore a
Hodge
T-shirt which said, oh, Martin Hodge, right, that's
Martin
right.
Hodge.
I also love Neville Southall's wife.
I think Martin Hodge was playing for Sheffield Wednesday against him, and he wore a T-shirt saying, I also love Neville Southall's wife.
Well, hats off to you, Martin Hodge. Hats off indeed.
Yeah.
The international chapters, certainly the stuff in the 80s. I mean, I have no recollection of, all I know that Wales were not successful. I mean, of course, I can't remember their qualifying games and stuff. All I ever remember, I think I mentioned this before, is that Wales had a manager called Mike England, who was the proudest Welshman, and that blew my little tiny child brain at the time. But yeah, I mean, the chapters on his international career is basically just a litany of failure.
And the players that they had as well, like, you would have thought Did have done better.
Well, I think in the current format, in like a 32-team Euros, Wales with Dean Saunders and Ian Rush.
Mark Hughes, Rangis, Gary Speed, not all at once, mind, but...
Yeah. And of course, Neville Southall, who was, at least to me when I was a kid, who I understood to be the best keeper in the world. Yeah, you would have thought they would have done better because they had proper pros as well. Your Barry Horns, he was a first division player. He was someone who would have been able to hold his own. But yeah, the whole of the international, I found that quite boring. Later on, I found quite entertaining his digs at the Welsh FA, who he describes as butchers, bakers and candlestick makers. What gives them the right to pick a manager? And I think he's probably right with that. Like, I'm sure at the time
that this stuff, just because Irish football has been kind of destroyed, really, in a way by the Football Association. You've heard of John Delaney, presumably.
Yep.
So just to hear the kind of like carry on in the kind of administrative side of Welsh football was interesting because it sounds so familiar from an Irish point of view. Like, I thought some of it was interesting though, you know, like, and again, like just different time and different world, like going to his first away trip was to Georgia behind the Iron Curtain. And they went to Russia again behind the Iron Curtain. And he said they played, you know, against Russia in 80,000 seater stadium, which was full, but was full of soldiers. And he said that just on the streets, no, all the stuff you hear all the time, nobody was smiling. And he felt that if they got a result against Russia, that maybe it would have an impact on the players' lives.
He had a few notable European trips, and yeah, they all sound hideously badly organised. He went training in the middle of the night one time, past the curfew, and the manager at the time, who escapes me, said he didn't realise because he hadn't changed his watch. So he didn't know he was playing in the middle of the night.
He liked playing for Wales. You'd have these world superstars, Ian Rush, Mark Hughes. And then he said, then you'd have fellas who were playing like third division. So like, again, not dissimilar to Ireland. So he said that once, he said that under Mike England, this Mike England guy was really passionate and dedicated, but just really eccentric and disorganized. He says that Mike England would be like, they were playing against France. It's like, he was saying to one of the defenders, now stick close to the number 10, kept saying the number 10. And that number 10 was like Platini, who was like the biggest player in the world at the time, but he couldn't remember his name, which is quite nice.
Yeah, it was nice. Yeah, he speaks very fondly of his international teammates, especially the ones who played at the lower level. And the ones he saw playing internationally, so, but he had a good game that game. Why didn't someone give him a chance in the top division? I thought he sounded quite sweet and naive there. Like, it's like, well, if he's good enough to play with me for Wales, he's good enough in the top division. It's like,
well, if he has Ruud Gullit and Marco van Basten in his pocket, that's the guy you're talking about.
Yeah, that's who it is.
One of the interesting things that he was around for, very sad, obviously, was when Wales played Scotland to qualify for the 86 World Cup. And if Wales were won, they'd qualify. Before the match, he said during the warm-up, he would warm up with five or six balls and they all went into the crowd. He was warming up in front of the Scots and they weren't giving the balls back. So he went over to Jock Stein to complain to Jock Stein. Jock Stein being the manager of Scotland at the time, the famous Celtic manager. And he went over to the crowd, Jock Stein did, and told them to give the balls back. So they did. They obliged. And then, anyway, Wales conceded a penalty. He thought it was harsh enough. And he was sick because he let it in. He said that he shouldn't have let it in. He should have stopped it. But Wales were out and Scotland went through. But that game was very famous because at full time, Jock Stein died of a heart attack. He's one of those fellas, you see pictures of him and he looks old. But he wasn't even 63, according to Southall.
Yeah, I mean, crikey, that's traumatic. And Alex Ferguson was on the was the assistant manager that day, wasn't he? I think.
Yes.
Back in the day.
Yes, that's right. And on the penalties thing, he said that he never watched penalties to study the taker. He just went entirely on instinct. He also said that he never watched footage of himself. Wouldn't watch Match of the Day. Wouldn't watch anything.
Yeah, I can understand that, the scruffy bastard. I mean, he really was, as we say, it's a different time. You can't go on instinct, eh? I mean, like penalty takers, you got to study that, right? You got to study that. You got it written on your water bottle. That's what you need to do. Everyone knows that.
So they won the FA Cup against Watford, and the following year they won the Cup Winners Cup. But he says the semi final against Bayern Munich. He talks about at the end of the book. There's kind of a this weird thing where he answers questions that people had sent into him somehow. But one of the questions was like his highlight, his career highlight, and he says that this match against Bayern Munich in the Cup Winners Cup semi final was the highlight. If you had to pick one.
Yeah, and that's one of the tragedies, eh? Because had it not been for the ban on English teams, he probably would have played in a lot more big games. You know, he should have been playing away at Real Madrid and Barcelona and AC Milan in those days, but he never really got the chance.
Yeah, and the fallout of that, which I never, like we talked earlier about, I knew that he was a player for Barcelona. I didn't know the Bayern Munich connection, but then Ian Rush, these guys who went abroad, Lineker, I never, you know, put two and two together. A lot of them were going abroad because of the ban after Heysel, which meant that they couldn't play in Europe. So that's the reason that some of these guys left. And it's the reason that Howard Kendall left to go to Atletico Bilbao, which was an interesting connection.
Yeah, that's it. You can do better than Bilbao. You've just won the league. Yeah, I mean, like there was a point in the 80s where half the England team played for Rangers because they could play European football.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
I mean, that's quite a sign-off, though, isn't it? You want to play against Liverpool and Man United and Arsenal every week, or Greenock Morton and Dumbarton, but you do get a couple of European games thrown in.
You know, I suppose, yeah, I guess, I'm sure I said it before, like, what I enjoy in these books is just when any of the players are weird. That's, I think, the thing that I enjoy the most. And he said there was this guy, had you heard of him? Derek Mountfield? Had you heard of him before?
Derek Mountfield, yeah, I remember him. I think he had a tash.
Yeah, I looked him up. He did have a tash. But anyway, he just loved his wife. And he'd come, this is remarkable. He'd come to the training ground with his wife. I think her name was Laura, maybe. And they'd pull out cushions with their names, whatever, crocheted into the cushion. And they'd sit down and have picnics there. Now, my understanding of football dressing rooms is that they're harsh environment.
Yeah.
So it kind of sounds like Derek was inviting a little bit of trouble there, you know.
But he's a centre-back, eh? Big centre-back with a tash, like. He could probably get away with it. He was a 1980s Stephen Ireland.
That's funny.
But instead of, a customised Bentley, it was a crocheted cushion. Sounds about right.
Yeah, that sounds about right. They won the league and the Cup Winners' Cup in 1984. Having beaten Bayern Munich, they beat Rapid Vienna 3-1 in the final. But he doesn't really talk about that because he's like he was so enamored with the semi-final. But it ended on a sour note when they failed to win a treble because Norman Whiteside, as we know, scored the winning goal in the 1985 Cup final for Manchester United against Everton.
Yeah, it was one of those before my time.
He lost 3 FA Cup finals. I was trying to see if he had lost the most, but I couldn't find that anywhere. I couldn't find that fact anywhere. But I did find who's won the most. Do you know who's won the FA Cup the most?
Ashley Cole.
Very good. 7
Thank
times.
Thank you very much. I know, it's astonishing, right?
Yeah. And which manager has won it most?
Ooh. Wenger?
Yes, very good.
Oh, boom! Lovely stuff.
Everton and... I think Chelsea have lost 8 cup finals, but one team has lost 9. Who is it?
United?
Yes!
Man! FA Cup knowledge. Lovely stuff.
This is when he kind of talks about Heysel. Heysel is when Liverpool went to play Champions League in Heysel, which is in Belgium, against Juventus. And essentially people were drinking all day and there was a kind of a riot and a wall collapsed and it killed, do you remember how many? It was 30 something.
Yeah, it was about that.
Yeah. But Southall, as you say, Southall is a contrarian, but he has a different view. And, you know, I did find it kind of compelling. He says that all English clubs and English fans were blamed essentially for what happened. But he says that there was blame in various parts. He largely blamed UEFA. For picking, like he said that when they played in the Netherlands and everything went really smoothly, but he said the Belgian police weren't able to handle anything. And he said that also the ground that they were playing in Heysel was an old ground. So he said there was blame spread around and he thought it was very unfair. Obviously, his career was deeply affected by it. But to be fair to Southall, at different times in the book, when things have happened involving things of much greater gravity, it doesn't sound fake or insincere. He really does talk about how, you know, at the end of the day, football doesn't matter so much, but it obviously did have a big impact on his career at the same time, you know?
Well, that's right. And yeah, Heysel, I think, was famously inadequate. But he also gets a little bit conspiracy theory there because English clubs were so dominant in Europe at that time. He feels that UEFA are also just like, oh, let's give someone else a chance, like ban them all. I remember feeling real bitterness at the time because Forest were a good team back then and we would have been in Europe year after year. You know, which would have meant more money, which meant more money for Forest, which would probably would have meant we didn't get fucking relegated in the very first season of a Premier League and forever be playing catch up.
Yeah. A wing, a butterfly's wing flaps.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And now look at us.
Again, like not to kind of put too much emphasis on the football side of thing, but it was bad. It was bad timing for Everton because this is the only time in my lifetime that Everton have been any good is what coincided with this period of time when English teams couldn't play in Europe.
Yeah, that's right. And that's it. And which, yeah, resulted in them losing, you know, all their bright young stars, notably Gary Lineker.
Yeah.
Who he describes as a nice fella. Yep, lovely stuff. It's great to get the insight there. Nice fella. All right, moving on.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't dish much dirt.
I don't know, though. I thought he would have a go at people. I thought, you know. I think he comes across as quite an unvarnished fellow or something, like, you know.
Yeah, that's right. I think if he feels wronged, he's prepared to do it. He's very uncomplimentary about some people.
Yeah.
But you don't really get much of a team dynamics, if you know what I mean. You made him click. He talks about people he admires and people as good players, but you don't get that inside the dressing room sort of thing, I thought.
Because he wasn't part of it. Like, he says that he just didn't hang around with anyone. He was a kind of quite an aloof kind of loner who he said he would kind of float between different groups. He said the fact that he didn't drink obviously puts him at a disadvantage, but he doesn't seem to have been interested in connecting with people. He says, I can't remember, maybe it was Rats. He says that he was one of the only people in football who ever bothered to get to know me, which is remarkable.
Yeah, I guess so. But yeah, he was, you know, very much a loner. I mean, he set himself apart and I guess that's what happened.
To give a taste, and I'm jumping ahead, but it's such a good story, you know, on the FA Cup connection. Like, so 1995 when they beat United to win the cup, and he had this, it was really towards the end of his career, and he had this blinding game and some famous saves, and everybody went out and got absolutely smashed, and he drove back to Wales.
Yeah.
Drove home, and then on the way home, he passed some United fans broken down on the side of the dual carriageway, and he picked them up. There you go.
Yeah, give him a lift. Yeah, what must they have thought? What must they have thought?
They must have thought, who is this maniac? Kendall left, went to Atletico Bilbao. Yeah, he was replaced by his number two. This is a remarkable kind of turn of events. Obviously, it's not unusual for a number two to take over from the manager, but when it didn't work out for Harvey and the manager brought back, you're posted back down to Sergeant Colin Harvey.
Yep. But he really loved Colin Harvey, eh? I mean, like, of anyone he speaks of warmly, he speaks very warmly of Colin Harvey.
Yeah, he does.
Talking of cup finals in the 1980s, do you remember they had a full members' cup, which was an attempt to try and replace European football for English teams?
Yeah.
And he lost in the final, 4-3 to Nottingham Forest. Well, I was there, Johnny. I saw that game. Yep, so I saw Neville in the flesh. And it was one of the highlights of my young footballing life. That was 4-3, an absolute ding-dong of a game. And Gary Parker, the elephant, do you remember Gary Parker? Went on to play for Villa.
Yes.
Ran the length of the pitch to score a goal. Look it up. It's absolutely magnificent.
And Southall says that nobody was interested in that cup whatsoever, apart from him and apparently you.
And me. I was loving it. The Simod Cup, mate. Come on!
So what he said was that under Harvey, it didn't really click. And he said that Everton just kind of bought players that were grand, but they didn't really kick on. He talks about Liverpool buying Barnes and Lineker. As you said, he left Everton to go to Spain, and then when he came back, he went to Spurs. And Southall indicates they had opportunities to sign those guys, and they didn't. And instead, they signed Tony Cottee, and he kind of damns Tony Cottee a bit with faint praise, doesn't he?
Yeah, I thought he was super harsh on Tony Cottee.
The thing about Southall stories is they're just very Southall, aren't they? He got a call from a Scottish man saying that he was Alex Ferguson.
He told him to
Southall,
fuck off, did he?
yeah. Well, Southall said, but it's Andy Gray, so he, like Andy Gray's former team was like, fuck off, and he hung up the phone. And then Fergie called him back. It was actually Fergie.
But it didn't happen for him.
Yeah, I
You're
wonder.
lucky it didn't, because maybe Schmeichel never would have happened if they got Southall in.
Well, that's it. He bought Schmeichel instead of Southall. There you
So it
go.
turned out quite well.
Yeah. So he didn't vibe with Martin Keown, and he said that Martin Keown was like, if Neville Southall thinks you're odd, you're either extremely odd or just not odd at all, I guess. But he thought that Keown was at once really arrogant and really sensitive, which is kind of fun, like Donald Trump or something. He said that
Or me.
he said that he gave Martin Keown gave Kevin Sheedy 4 stitches on the night out. Sheedy was winding up Keown's brother. Keown apparently has quite thin skin.
Well, there you go. Keown is sensitive. Talking of favourites, who pops up in this book again? Old Stevie McMahon. He
Yes, and
transcends all football.
he's like, this was Steve McMahon's opportunity to be kind of cast as the good guy, because he was Southall's teammate, but he just doesn't really say anything about him.
There's not much. Yeah, I was looking going through the index, but he liked him as a player, but the crowd didn't like him because the crowd had decent instincts.
Yeah, so this is when Kendall came back. Colin Harvey's back as his number two, which is just funny.
Down you go, lad.
Yeah, it's funny. And this is when Dalglish left Liverpool. So this is 1991. And he says here that Dalglish had brought a real touch of class, that kind of post Hillsborough stuff. He said Dalglish went to everything, all the funerals, was always there, kind of supporting fans. Then I think about Dalglish with the Suarez stuff later with the t-shirt. It's a bit of a change of.
That was an older Dalglish. Liverpool do get these managers though, wouldn't they? Like, you can imagine Klopp doing something like that. Just despite my feelings towards him, yeah, some of the managers are real classy.
Yeah, Klopp is a class act, isn't he? What did
I
you
don't want to
think?
speculate. I mean, I think if there were a tragedy, then Klopp would attend all those funerals as well. I would imagine.
That's funny. I was surprised by the Beardsley stuff.
Yeah, Beardsley was a boy, apparently. Hey, like that was unusual. I wasn't
Yeah.
expecting that either.
So here, this is, I've got, so Beardsley didn't drink. So maybe that's why Southall and him vibed. But Beardsley was like kind of very energetic and very nice. So I've got a line here. He always made sure everybody was happy on the bus and brought all sorts of cakes for everyone. And also had a collection of videos to keep us amused. Peter was an absolute diamond fella. It's like so Southall. It's just so straightforward.
Yeah, that was nice. Yeah, well, I wasn't expecting that because, yeah, he said he was, yeah, very popular among the group. Whereas, I mean, I just imagine he would have sort of been exiled in the corner like some little. I think my perception of Peter Beardsley has been too tarnished by Atletico Mintz, and I just see him
Absolutely.
as his absolute loser character.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
there's been controversy recently about Peter Beardsley, so his legacy is a bit tarnished. But that transfer was one
Yeah.
time when Everton got it right.
Everton won the league in 1984 and 1986, but then they just kind of drifted. And year to year, we're getting into the 90s now as the Premier League is coming on stream. They're just finishing lower and lower. 1992, they finished 12th. And then at this stage, Southall was the sole survivor of the 1984 team that won the league. 1984, 1985, 1984.
They won the league in 85 and 87.
And what he says, and I thought it was interesting, he says that football was changing and everything were getting left behind. Sky were like about to kind of obviously which helped like pump all this money and kind of repackage football and sports science had arrived on the scene. Everton were firing shots at the faces of the UTS players. They had a 100-year-old chairman, John Moores, and were going out for Chinese meals to patch things up when there were problems.
The old firing things at the youth team players, eh? That was one of Howard Kendall's tricks, right? That's how you got to impress him, how you just like put your face in the way, like they're coming off all bloodied and bruised. Like.
Yeah, he says like blood, like fellas, like young lads throwing their face at the ball moving at 100 miles an hour.
I'm prepared to speculate Phil Foden's never been put in that position.
No. Do you remember the song, the Everton song from the 1995 FA Cup final?
I'm afraid not.
You know All Together Now by The Firm?
Yeah, I do.
So they sang All Together Now for Everton. I actually remember it distinctly from that time. And that was later the England 2006 Euro song. And it was, you know, that song was produced by Suggs from Madness.
Oh, no kidding. There you go.
And do you know what that song is about, Al?
No, I don't.
That is about the famous football on Christmas Day in the First World War.
Oh, the Armistice Day one.
All together now in no man's land.
Oh, well, there you are. Look at that.
There you go.
Hey, man. Good knowledge. Yeah. Now, wasn't that the same year that Manchester United had that song with Status Quo?
Come on, your heads.
Wasn't that for the Rat Cup final too, though?
I think that was also about the 1914 World War. Yeah, was that? Yeah, I'm not. Yeah, I think maybe, but was that the very?
Because he talked about Kaczelskis and gigs, right? So it must have been around then.
Yeah, the timing sounds right. Yeah,
yeah, much more groovy than Everton, eh? They had the cool farm.
Yeah,
and you had sucky old Status Quo, Dad Rock.
Yeah, well, John Coughlin, the drummer. Hello. The Farmer are Liverpool fans, interestingly enough.
Oh, that is interesting.
Yes.
If I was in a band, I would never let Notts County use my music. Never in a million years.
You said that he doesn't dish enough dirt. He does say things that he says at various times that he liked everyone. He liked everyone in football.
Yeah, he does say that.
Which just seems remarkable.
Yeah, although there's a couple of people who don't quite escape him. Mike Walker, the ex-Norwich manager, went on to be Everton.
Yeah, I think this is what you said it in the context of, yeah.
Yeah, he was all suntan, wasn't he, that kid? Like, just a flash Harry. I mean, I remember he must have been the manager when Norwich beat Bayern Munich, though, right? I mean, he can't have been a total clown.
Yeah, Jeremy Goss.
Jeremy Goss.
Mike Walker was a goalkeeper. Can you think of... Well, I know Nottingham Forest currently have a goalkeeper manager, but can you think of many managers who are goalkeepers? There's not many. I'd say less than 1 in 11 anyway.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, what's it? Yeah, less than 9%, right? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because they're weirdos.
Well, this is what Southall would make you believe anyway.
Well, like Rude Hullett said, you're only a goalkeeper because you can't play football.
He says... Managing Norwich is not the same as managing Everton. When he's talking about Mike Walker, he said that the expectations and stuff at Everton were much higher. He said that Walker was clueless. They beat Wimbledon 3-2 on the last day of the season. They were 2 down to stay up. And this is, I watched this goal, right, on YouTube. And I said out loud, humdinger, when Horn scored. And then the commentator goes, humdinger from Horn.
Not kidding.
Yeah, it's quite nice. Anyway, Hansager was in goal for that. And then I vaguely recalled Hansager was in court later for like taking bungs. Specifically, this game was one of the ones that came up.
The Wimbledon game where Everton stayed up. Is that one you're talking
yeah,
about?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I remember that at the time. I really do. I think I was in a boozer. And I was too young to be in a boozer. But I do, and I was like, Everton, this is happening. Everton are getting relegated. Because even then, as a kid, I was like, Everton are one of the, you know, they've never been relegated, right?
Yeah,
or at least not in 100 years.
No, they're the only team that haven't been, no.
The only one. Yeah, okay. Yeah. And yeah, that was always the talk. It was dodgy right from the off. It was dodgy. I thought it was dodgy at the time. And yeah, but he absolutely gives Hansager a pass there, right?
He totally gives Hansager a pass. He says that Barry Horn kicked the ball at Walker because Walker called him horny. But when I was a young fella, there was a fella with the same surname in my hometown, and he didn't like being called horny either. I remember he used to get very cross. He'd give you a chase.
Well, fun little anecdote. I basically misunderstood what horny meant until I was in my 20s. And I used to describe women as horny if I thought they were sexy. So I'd say, she's so horny, which I thought meant she was really sexy, when in fact I was expressing that she was sexually voracious. Yeah, I got that word wrong for many, many years.
That's funny. You know, there's a good line in Peep Show when Mark says, when did horny take over from Randy?
Yeah, well, that was my word. Randy met Randy, and horny meant sexy to me.
Anyway, okay.
What's the best football reference in Peep Show?
Well, the 3-0 Walcott stuff.
Yep, 3-0 Walcott. That still makes me laugh. And I think the Daily Star did print 3-0 Walcott. Did. Yeah, they nice. Did.
And not only that, but they put the person who wrote the article was Jeremy Osborne.
Oh, was it?
Nice.
Those people went on to make Succession. So well done indeed.
Yeah. He went on a pre-season tour to Sweden, and he says it was just so Mike Walker could work on his tan. But there was a mix-up with the kit, and his kit wasn't there. So he just walked out onto in the training ground in the nip, you know, wearing gloves and his boots.
Yeah, the kit man chasing him out with his proper uniform. Yeah, that's one way of protesting, isn't it, Mark?
Yeah, but I had a question for you. Mike Walker won 5 games in 11 months, including 14 games without a win at the start of the 94-95 season. Would you have won a game if you're the manager?
Yeah, like I thought so. Maybe, maybe. Forrester on a run of 1 win in 13. So,
God,
I'm feeling it, baby.
Mike Walker was ahead of his time.
Yeah, like, he was. We take him now.
50 passes in his own half.
Yeah, that's it. But that was not the football that Everton were renowned for at the time, eh? The old dogs of war.
Yeah. So Joe Royler comes in, and he was the man for the dogs of war.
Yeah, and that's it. Joe Royler is one of them who he liked, but slagged him off. In fact, devoted a whole chapter in his own autobiography to slagging off Neville Southall.
Yes.
A whole chapter. He was a weak link and on the wane.
Yeah. Royal obviously didn't like him, yeah. And he says that, yeah, so they switched this kind of kick and rush type approach, modelled on AC Milan of the day.
Yeah, that's right. Also, I mean, apparently Neville Southall used to ring into phone-ins to defend Joe Royal as well, apparently, at the time.
Yeah.
Much good it did him.
He talks about Duncan Ferguson, and he reckons Ferguson should have been the best player in the world.
I mean, perhaps a touch of hyperbole, though. But yeah, he only played big games, Big Dunk, right?
Yeah, and it was a pigeon. He was a pigeon fancier.
Yeah, I think we knew that, didn't we? Yeah.
Going back to Barry Horn quickly, he says that Southall describes him as the most intense man he ever met, which is interesting. He said he was like wicked smart. He would read, watch television, listen to the radio at once. That's incredible. Anyway, and he says that like he'd just be.
Is that that's how it I should have made a highlight of that. Like, should see my missus. She can look at her phone and watch TV at the same time. She's unbelievable, like a modern day Einstein.
Yeah. Barry Horn used to be
yeah, that tickled me for some reason. Yeah. Oh, can you believe this lad? Like, that's the metric.
He said that Barry Horn used to have to share a room with poor old Neville, and Neville would sleep on the floor because he had a bad back. So Barry Horn used to piss in a pot. He used to piss in a teapot. Do you remember anything he said about Daniel Amakachi?
Oh, what did he say about Daniel Amakachi?
Well, you said he didn't dish the dirt. He said Daniel Amakachi had a BO problem.
That was yes, I remember that. That was unnecessary, wasn't it? That was unnecessary.
It was Amakachi sent him to the FA Cup.
He said he enjoyed that cup final win the most because he knew that was going to be the last one.
2 FA Cup wins bookended his career, 84 and 95. But roughly, but And around the same time, he went to see the Queen. He got an MBE. And he says he didn't like wearing suits. And then he says that his, like, he would still look ridiculous, so he never used to wear them. And then he said he had to wear one for the Queen. And this is the term he used. He said, "I still look like a rat bag," which I enjoyed.
And the Queen asked him, "What are you going to do now that you're retired?" And that hurt his feeling because he wasn't
Yeah.
retired.
No, he wasn't retired.
The Queen didn't do a research like we do.
Yeah, exactly. So he played 751 games by my count for
In my
Everton.
head, it's 768, but I didn't
Yeah,
write it down.
he
But
described them
yeah,
all.
700 odd games for Everton. Yeah, he's the all-time Everton leading appearance maker, right?
Yeah,
All-time
and
clean sheet maker.
yeah, he played 92 times for Wales. He never got to a major competition with Wales, and his Wales career ended on a bit of a funny note as well. They just missed out on qualification for 1994 under Terry Urath, and he liked Terry Urath, but then Bobby Gould came in. Bobby Gould had been the Wimbledon manager when they won the FA Cup in 1987. Anyway, in the 80s,
89.
89 was it? But he said Bobby Gould was a total cowboy, kind of clueless. And he said that one day they were just training and Bobby Gould just randomly started challenging all of the players to wrestling matches.
But who did he pick to wrestle? Like, who would you pick to wrestle at first? Well, I'll tell you, the lad he chose to wrestle is not the lad I would have chosen to
Yeah.
wrestle.
John Hurtson broke his ribs.
Yeah,
Yeah, and
Bobby Gould
then
also brought in Vinnie Jones.
yes.
And made him captain, which seemed a bold move.
He had a falling out with Gould. Gould had him in kind of as a coach, but he had a bad relationship with Gould. And he took him off at half time in a game against Turkey. And that was the end of his Wales career. And his Everton career kind of just petered out as well. Southall has tried to be a manager. And it hasn't worked out for him. Like he did some lower, like kind of non-league stuff, but it didn't work out for him. And he always felt like he didn't get chances. And it may be because people think he's a bit strange, but he says, just look at football. It's just the same people all of the time. And he says, look at Steve Bruce. He said at the time I think he was managing, maybe it was Bradford, and it was his eighth management gig. And he said, has Steve Bruce ever really achieved anything? Which I thought was fairly cutting. I've looked it up as well. Bruce has, how many management roles do you think Bruce has had now?
I'm going to say 12.
Get out, look at this.
Oh, lad. It's just ingrained in me. I can't help myself. I know it.
Kind of ended on a sour note with Everton, which is sad given that he kind of dedicated his entire career there. And then he bounced around between a couple of different teams. He was playing and coaching. He was kind of a goalkeeper coach. He went to play for Torquay. He went to Stoke and he absolutely hated Stoke.
Oh, he had a horrible time. The worst mistake of his career. This was a player. And when I was a kid, that was who to me was the best goalkeeper in the world. That's who I was told in my Match magazine and Shoot
Oh.
magazine, the best goalkeeper in the world. But he was so prepared to drop down the leagues just because he loved to play. I mean, he went from Everton to Southend, who were then in the second division. I mean, surely there must have been other opportunities.
Yeah. And he never seemed to be on good money. Like he said, like he talked about other fellas who were playing for Everton who I'd literally never heard of in the 90s who were getting paid more than them, you know.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, well, it was testament. I mean, it seems like he couldn't retire on the money he made from football by any means. How many footballers go on to do what he did? Players
Yeah.
of that stature. This is a player who was voted the 97th greatest player in the history of world football in 1999.
Really, was he? It's quite nice, isn't it? But
Yeah.
yeah, that was it. It kind of petered out for him. And so the reason that Southall has kind of been in the news more recently is because he's become something of an unusual phenomenon on Twitter. At least he was, because he was engaging people in discussions on fairly loaded and weighty subjects, but in very much the opposite way to a lot of people in football, namely Joey Barton. He was asking transgender people, for example, for just to explain things to him, you know? So this is kind of how he had been in my mind recently. So he is a very unusual chap, isn't he?
Yeah, that's it. No, he's a big proponent for the underdog, isn't he? I mean, he'll give his Twitter account over to people who he feels need a voice and will be a big advocate for those people. Which Crouchy mentions him, right? Crouchy mentions how much he loves him for that.
Yeah, and he said he became a teacher. Like, after through coaching, he ended up coaching some underprivileged kids, and he really got into this, and that's what he does now. He set up a business that he's kind of a consultant, and he's hired to this kind of work where he works with, like, essentially to give people who've kind of been fallen out of education another route into employment by giving them skills and stuff like that. And he also fosters kids with his second wife. This is a really he's a really decent guy. Like,
I mean, that's it. I looked it up, and yeah, as of 2018, obviously not that recently, but he was fostering two kids. I mean, good for you, lad. And that's it. And he seemed to have a real affinity with these kids as well. I mean, they'd give him dogs abuse, and he'd be like, I've had that from 50,000 people. Keep going, like you can't hurt me." And that's how he said he can get through to these kids, eh? Like, because he's just so thick-skinned, and obviously has such compassion in his heart. Yeah, he really is a thoroughly decent weirdo.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I really, like, I as I said, I'm repeating myself, but I thought at the start that there was going to be a bit of a slog, but I kind of fell for Neville.
Yeah, thoroughly decent bloke.
Anyway, yeah, what would you give this book out of 5?
Yeah, I'd say there are moments, particularly the early Everton stuff, where it didn't have much resonance with me because it was a little bit before my time. I was like, But yeah, it ended up, there were some funny stories. And he is a nice man. I'd say 4.
I think I'd give it 4 out of 5 as well. And for the same reasons that you said, reading about the 80s wasn't that interesting to me. But like I said, I just found him a very compelling character for, like, just a very unusual character. I don't think I've encountered a character like Neville Saddall before. But yeah, so I would say 4 out of 5 is good. So let's say 4 I Love My Wife t-shirts out of 5 for,
yeah.
For
4 out
for
of
Neville.
I Love Neville Southall's Wife 2 t-shirts.
Very nice. Very nice. Okay. And then, well, our next episode is episode 10. And, well, who's the most famous number 10?
Maradona.
Yes.
Who was the absolute behemoth of football when I was a kid, eh? He was the one, the biggest star in the world, bar none.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you very much for listening to old Neville Southall. Yeah, this is one we'd recommend, right? We'd recommend you read this book.
Yeah, I thought it was fun. I think it's fun.
Yeah. A nice man and an interesting story.
Yeah, an unusual fellow. Yeah. Thank you very much. We have a Twitter and an Instagram and all that. So please follow us and tell your friends to listen to the Adam Ola Bookman podcast. Thank you again to Dara Fennan for the music, and thank you, Alistair.
Thank you, Johnny. I can't